You're listening to VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Brian Lynn, Jill Robbins, and Faith Perlow. Later, Katie Weaver and Ashley will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Leaders of the United States, Japan, Australia, and India gathered in Tokyo on Tuesday for a meeting of the group known as the Quad. The issues of American support for Taiwan and Russia's war in Ukraine have gained attention recently. So did China's militarization in the disputed South China Sea and Australia's nuclear submarine program. But what is the group, and what is the importance of the partnership? The name Quad comes from the official name of the group, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. The Quad began as a loose partnership after the extremely destructive 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. At that time, the four countries joined together to provide humanitarian and disaster aid to the affected area, including Indonesia and several other countries. But the group was formalized by former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in 2007. The group did little for nearly 10 years. This was partly because of Australian concerns that its membership in the group would anger China. The group was resurrected in 2017, reflecting changing ideas in Asia about China's growing influence. The administrations of both former U.S. President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden believe the Quad is important to placing more attention on the Indo-Pacific area, especially to balance China's actions. The Quad leaders held their first official meeting of top leaders in 2021. They met again by video link in March. China has criticized the group as an attempt at forming an Asian NATO. However, the group is unlike the European Military Alliance, or North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because there is no mutual defense agreement in effect. Quad members say the group is meant to deepen economic, diplomatic, and military ties among the four countries. The members do not state that their partnership is meant to be a defensive alliance against Chinese aggression. In March 2021, members released a declaration describing the spirit of the Quad. The leaders said they aim to establish the Indo-Pacific as an area that is free, open, inclusive, healthy, anchored by democratic values, and unconstrained by coercion. Coercion describes causing a country to do something using force or threats. Tuesday's meeting marks the first in-person gathering of the group for Chinese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. Kishida took office last October. The meeting also provides an introduction for Australia's new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. He was sworn in on Monday, just 2 days after Australia's parliamentary election. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is also attending. Modi is facing increasing international pressure over several issues. His government's policies toward minorities have been criticized. India increased its purchases of Russian energy supplies after Russia invaded Ukraine. Other Quad members have placed strong restrictions on Russia's economy. And India has banned wheat exports at a time when world wheat supplies have been sharply reduced because of Russia's war. Indian officials blame hot spring weather, which led to a poor harvest, for cutting exports. South Korea has expressed interest in joining the Quad. U.S. officials have said they are not currently considering adding to the group's membership. The group has held Quad Plus meetings that have included South Korea, New Zealand, and Vietnam. These nations could form the basis for future expansion or partnership in the Indo-Pacific. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has been re-elected to a second term. His re-election was confirmed Tuesday by the WHO's governing body, the World Health Assembly. The vote came during a meeting in Geneva, Switzerland. The Assembly includes 194 member states. Tedros was the only candidate running for the position. His new term will officially begin on August 16, 2022. Tedros was first elected in 2017. Tedros is a former government minister from Ethiopia. He is the first African to lead the agency and the only director general who was not a medical doctor. Tedros directed the United Nations Health Agency through its efforts to fight the worldwide COVID-19 health crisis. He was sometimes criticized for WHO policies related to the pandemic. But he also enjoyed widespread support among UN members. Javier Guzman is the director of World Health Policy at the Center for Global Development in Washington. He told the Associated Press the WHO did experience some mishaps while dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. However, Guzman said Tedros had kept a steady voice during the crisis and that he supported equitable policies. Tedros has often been critical of wealthy nations who resisted sharing COVID-19 supplies with developing countries. He also called on drug companies to do more to make their vaccines available to the poor. Guzman said that while some countries had concerns about Tedros's leadership, they were not willing to currently push for a change. "We are in the middle of the pandemic, and there is some pressure for consistent leadership to take us through this difficult moment." Still, critics say Tedros had failed on several important issues. Some questioned his leadership during one of the biggest sex scandals in UN history. It involved accusations that dozens of workers managed by the WHO sexually abused young women in the Democratic Republic of the Congo during an Ebola outbreak that began in 2018. None of the WHO managers who were told about the accusations and did little to stop the abuse have been fired. Tedros has been criticized for not holding the workers accountable for their actions. As Tedros begins his second term, some experts have also raised concerns that the WHO is not completing its duty to provide science-based guidance to member countries. Dr. David Tomlinson is a heart specialist who has campaigned for better protective equipment for health workers in Britain's health system. He told the AP he was surprised at some of the advice given by the WHO. One example he gave was the organization's unwillingness to admit that COVID-19 is widely spread in the air. In July 2020, more than 230 scientists published a paper appealing to the WHO to recognize that the coronavirus was airborne. The paper later persuaded the WHO to change some of its guidance on the subject. Tomlinson and others say Tedros and the WHO should aim in future health emergencies to get a full examination of the available science. "We need an agency that's unafraid to tell the truth, but that's unfortunately not what we have," Tomlinson said. I'm Brian Lynn.
As the war in Ukraine continues, there is increasing evidence that Russia has knowingly attacked schools. Attacks on civilian structures are considered a possible war crime. The Ukrainian government says Russia has shelled over 1,000 schools and has destroyed 95. The Associated Press said the large amount of wreckage and damage is evidence that Russia knew that it was targeting schools. Recent attacks include a school in the eastern village of Bilohorivka, where a bomb destroyed the school. On March 3rd, School 21 in Chernihiv was bombed. School teacher Ina Levchenko had reopened School 21 to shelter scared families. She has taught there for 30 years. School officials painted the word children in large letters on the windows. Russia bombed the school anyway. Levchenko was buried under wreckage, and her legs were broken. She could not see because of blood and dust, but she could hear screams. Just before the attack, she had ordered 70 children to shelter in the basement of the school. They would survive, but 9 other people, including a 13-year-old boy who was her student, would not. Livchenko said, "Why schools? I cannot comprehend their motivation. It is painful to realize how many friends of mine died, and how many children, who remained alone without parents, got traumatized. They will remember it all their life, and will pass their stories to the next generation." The Associated Press and the PBS series Frontline have been investigating the incidents. The two reported that they have independently confirmed that Russia has destroyed 57 schools. They say the attacks were carried out in a way that suggests possible war crimes. These schools represent a few of the many possible war crimes. Ukraine's Prosecutor General, Irina Vinodikhtova, the International Criminal Court, and others are investigating more than 8,000 possible war crimes involving hundreds of suspects. They say Russia is targeting schools, hospitals, and other civilian buildings. By targeting schools, Russia is taking a secure and nurturing space for children and changing them into places of fear and violence. A school director from the town of Gorlovka, Sergei But, said, "It's a tragedy for us. It's a tragedy for the children. His school was a place where children flew kites and took photos of their friends. Now," he said, "it is in ruins, with broken glass and wreckage." Two teachers, Yelena Kudryk, the geography teacher, and Yelena Ivanova, the assistant director of the school, were killed. In towns like Okhtyrka, cluster bombs, shelling, and gunfire have destroyed several kindergartens. Young children, teachers, and parents have been killed. Valeria Grusha has taught in Kyiv province for 35 years. She said that just as school administrators had started to prepare for the war, Russian troops invaded. They stopped teaching and called Ukrainian leaders. Grusha said, "When I started talking to the directors of the destroyed and robbed institutions, they were very worried, crying, telling with pain and regret."
Russian officials deny attacking civilian buildings like schools and hospitals. Local media in Russian-held Gorlovka said Ukrainian forces caused the explosion that killed 2 teachers while trying to recapture the town. War crime experts say it will be difficult to prove the intent of the attacks, even with the destruction and killing of civilians. David Bosco is a professor and researcher of international relations and war crimes at Indiana University. He said that prosecuting war crimes can be difficult. If the military uses civilian buildings, then those buildings can be wartime targets. The chief idea is to find a pattern of Russia targeting civilian buildings, like schools, as a military approach. The more you can show a pattern, then the stronger the case becomes that this was really a policy of not discriminating between military and civilian facilities, Bosco said. Surviving such conflicts like war and having schools destroyed hurts teachers and students for generations to come. Bosco said schools are supposed to be a safe place. He said, "Destroying that is, in essence, attacking the next generation." Abdul Kafi Alhamdu is a Syrian teacher from Aleppo, Syria. Yasminko Halalovich is a 34-year-old from Sarajevo in present-day Bosnia-Herzegovina. Both men have seen school destroyed by war and suffering. Alhamdu saw these things during the Syrian civil war in 2014, and Halilovic saw it during the Bosnian War in the early 1990s. Alhamdu remembers the children's paintings dripping with blood after a bomb exploded during an artwork presentation. He said that creating fear, hopelessness, and anger in the children is the goal of the enemy. Alhamdu said, "When they see their school destroyed, do you know how many dreams have been destroyed?" Halilovic was a young child during the Bosnian War. He also went to school in underground rooms. He has founded the War Childhood Museum. It records children's stories and saves objects from wartime. He has worked with displaced Ukrainian children since the start of the invasion of the Donbas area in Ukraine in 2014. He recently had to remove himself and his workers because of the current conflict. Halilovic said, "Once the fighting ends, the new fight will start, to rebuild cities, to rebuild schools and infrastructure, and to rebuild society, and to heal. And to heal is the most difficult," he said. More than half of Ukrainian children have been displaced. Schools have become shelters, and the war has forced learning underground. Millions of children are continuing their studies on the internet. International aid organizations like Save the Children and UNICEF have been working with the government to set up internet learning programs. Save the Children said in a statement, "Educating every child is essential to preventing grave violations of their rights." I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Faith Perlow.
On our national parks journey, we are exploring the oldest national park east of the Mississippi River. Much of the park sits on a rocky island off the coast of Maine called Mount Desert Island. Here, you will find the tallest mountain on the east coast. You will also find black bears, moose, and more than 300 kinds of birds. This national park also holds unique Native American and European history. It is called Acadia. The 14,000-hectare park is one of the smaller major national parks in the country. Yet Acadia sees almost 3 million visitors every year. They come to experience stunning views and take part in outdoor activities like hiking and biking and swimming in the crisp blue Atlantic Ocean.
Acadia National Park has had many names throughout history. It was first declared a national monument in 1916. Its name, Sierre des Monts National Monument, was changed by Congress in 1919. It then became known as Lafayette National Park. In 1929, the park became Acadia National Park, from a past name for the area. The name Acadia probably comes from Arcadia, an area of Greece. It is said that an Italian explorer working for the King of France sailed by the area in 1524. The explorer thought that the landscape looked like the Greek area of Arcadia.
Mount Desert Island also got its name from early European explorers. Frenchman Samuel Champlain arrived on the island in 1604. He described the island's tall peaks as bare and rocky.
He named the island, in French, Île des Monts Déserts, or Island of Desert Mountains. Today, locals still say the word desert, similar to its French pronunciation, désert. Champlain and his team were not, of course, the first humans on the island. Native Americans were the first to inhabit the area. Shells and other archaeological evidence on the island date back more than 5,000 years. The native Wabanaki people arrived there in boats made from the wood of birch trees. They hunted, fished, collected berries, and harvested clams from the sea. Wabanaki people called the island Pemetic, or sloping land.
This sloping land is home to Cadillac Mountain. It is the highest point along America's eastern coast, at 466 meters. The island owes its landscape to ancient glaciers that once covered the area. Cadillac Mountain is known as the first point in the U.S. that is touched by the rising sun each morning. The name of its early inhabitants, the Wabanaki, translates to People of the Dawn. Today, the summit of Cadillac Mountain is often packed with visitors, many of whom arrive in cars and buses. It is one of the major tourist attractions within the park.
Many tourists also visit what may be the most photographed rock in the state. Bubble Rock is a giant boulder. It sits right on the edge of the summit of South Bubble Mountain. It was moved here by powerful ancient glaciers. Bubble Rock looks as though the slightest wind may push it over the mountain's edge. Visitors often take photos of themselves trying to push the huge rock off the mountain. Of course, Bubble Rock does not move. The Bubble Rock Trail winds up South Bubble Mountain. It is one of the most popular hiking trails in the park. But Acadia does offer solitude for visitors hoping to enjoy the quiet of nature. Within the park are more than 200 kilometers of trails. Many lead to stunning views of the rocky main coast. Some take you to pebbled beaches or quiet lakes surrounded by forest.
Many visitors to Acadia spend most of their time exploring Mount Desert Island. But the Skudik Peninsula is equally beautiful. The National Park Service now protects more than 1,300 hectares of land there. Skudik offers secluded beaches and peaceful hiking trails.
In summer months, visitors can take a boat from the town of Bar Harbor on Mount Desert Island to the town of Winter Harbor on Skudik Peninsula. The tiny fishing town is a great place to enjoy Maine lobster in many forms. A few small family-owned restaurants serve classic Maine dishes like lobster soup, lobster rolls, or simple steamed lobster. But wherever visitors explore in Acadia, they will leave wishing they could see more. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.